processing.
Is that what we're breathing?
I just said I'm sensitive.
Okay, I'm going to call to order this hearing of the Senate Committee on Workforce and General Government. It is Friday, February 5th, 2016. Welcome, everyone. We are going to be devoting our entire session to Senate Bill 1532, and we are going to have a combination of work session and public hearing. And we are going to start out with just some information about the different amendments that are out there, and Jan is going to describe them. One of them has a connection to the issue that came up the other day about the unfunded mandate on local governments. And colleagues, you have an opinion from LC about that issue of the unfunded mandate, and we have LC here who can explain to us or answer any questions that you might have about it. We're then going to get a presentation on self-sufficiency. You know, remember I mentioned that the way that these counties are broken up is a function of what it takes to be self-sufficient in the individual counties. So that those where it takes a higher income to be self-sufficient, we're looking at a higher minimum wage for those areas. And that's a concept that those of us who went through the work group process are very familiar with. And then, you know, the other day, as I looked out at the audience's faces, I was reminded that not everyone has gone through that work group process. And so there are going to be some questions about, you know, so what is this self-sufficiency notion? And so Caitlin Baggett, who has testified before this committee before, she's working with an organization called the North Star Foundation, which has been collecting the data related to self-sufficiency. She's going to give us a little explanation of that. We'll then go into taking public testimony on Senate Bill 1532 and the amendments. And then we'll go into a work session where we'll consider amendments and perhaps vote out the bill. So, Jan, do you want to start off by on Thursday, which amazingly was just yesterday, we talked about the Dash 13s. We have also Dash 16s, 17s, and 19s that have come in, and they're all posted on the legislative information system. But Jan's going to summarize them for us, and we'll see if there are any questions about them.
Thank you, Chair Denbrough. And committee members, there should be paper copies of the amendments before you. And I think we have extras at the table for anyone in the audience, but they are posted on OLAS for everyone to access. So the 16 builds off of the 13, so it uses the same dollar amounts in the schedule. So it is, first of all, it's an amendment from Senator Farioli. So it uses the three regional schedules, the same dollar amounts that you will find in the chair's amendment, which is the Dash 13. But the difference being that it exempts any employee who's working for an employer that has fewer than 50 employees. So that is the Dash 16. And it, too, includes an emergency clause. The Dash 17 is also building off of the Dash 13, so again, it has the same dollar amount, the same time that the wages are phased in for the three regions. The difference being that it includes a refundable tax credit for the employer for any of their increased labor costs that are due to the minimum wage increase, and it too has an emergency clause. And that amendment was submitted by Senator Farioli. And are you looking for your amendment? They should all be right here.
Okay. No.
Then the Dash 19. This was an amendment submitted by Senator Thatcher. Like the 16 and the 17, it builds off of the same wage schedules in the Dash 13, same dollar amounts, same time frames for phasing in the minimum wage increases. The difference being that it includes an ability for a local government to set the minimum wage at $9.25 an hour. With future years, it would increase by the CPI. So basically, it keeps the status quo for the local government and the entities within the local government jurisdiction if that local government takes action to maintain the minimum wage at its current level. And it includes an emergency clause as well. Senator Denbro didn't mention, but we did put on OLIS an amendment that was mentioned, discussed in an earlier hearing, and that is the Dash 4 amendment from Senator Thompson. It is. It does not replace the original bill. Instead, it's an amendment to the original bill, and it just excludes an employee who is an agricultural worker.
Okay. Thanks, Jan. Thanks for that. So going back to the 19s, then that's the one that. Where it allows a local government to set its own minimum wage requirements, that would be at the 9 1/4. Senator Thatcher, that's your bill. Do you have anything to add to explain?
Well, we were hearing some concerns that maybe local governments should be able to, know their area and be able to set the minimum wage for their area. And since we're going for more of a statewide approach, let's look at, allowing those entities to opt out of the increase. So it was just kind of addressing some of the concerns of local governments saying, our area cannot support these increases. Let us, keep it how we have it now with the increases that are already built into the current statute. And it would also address some of the concerns and make it more clear for the schools, school districts, and the cities and counties. They're already struggling with additional costs. They're making it clear that this would create, an additional burden on them, and they might send this to court. This would kind of clarify it and keep it from having to go to that level. So.
Great. Thanks. So as I mentioned before, we do have an opinion from LC that suggests that they believe that an Oregon court would conclude that this, unfunded mandate section of the law that's based on Measure 30 does not apply to a bill that increases the state minimum wage. So why don't we call up LC Allen and Gail, and if you have any questions about this opinion.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I don't know if this applies here, but I just want to put it on the record that as yesterday, I want to be able to put people under oath that represent government agencies and are registered lobbyists, those two classes of people, not the public at large. So there you go.
Yeah. Okay. Welcome, Alan. Thank you. And Gail?
For the record, my name is Alan Dale, Senior Deputy Legislative Counsel. And, sorry.
I'm Gail Stevens, Deputy Legislative Counsel.
Yes. Thank you, both of you. So do you want to just kind of give us an overview of what the thinking was in the in this opinion?
Sure. Senator Denbro, members of the committee, the Article 11, Section 15 applies to a state law that requires a local government to establish a new program or provide an increased level of service for an existing program. So the idea, I think, is that the state law would be increasing the costs to the local government, and the local government would not have to comply under subsection 3 if an adequate appropriation is made to the local government, or under subsection 11 if a fee if the local government is authorized to compensate themselves for the cost with a fee or charge. Furthermore, under subsection 7, the whole section doesn't apply in certain circumstances, including if the state law is approved by a 3/5 majority in both houses, or if the law is passed by initiative or referendum of the people. So the question then is whether the Legislative Assembly increasing the state minimum wage is requiring a local government to establish a new program or to provide an increased level of service for an existing program. And the term program is defined in Section 15. The only potentially applicable definition is providing financial services to persons. So the argument would have to be that by increasing the minimum wage in the state, that the local government being required to pay higher wages to minimum wage employees is either establishing a new program or an increased level of service for an existing program, that is providing financial services to persons. So the minimum wage in general is already exists, so it seems like it would not be establishing a new program. So is it providing an increased level of service for an existing program? Program is defined, but undefined words, according to the courts, are given their plain, ordinary meaning. So you have to think, is providing financial services to persons what a local government is doing when they pay their employees? And that doesn't seem like a natural reading of those words to us. And, you know, I think if you think, for instance, of the county assessor, the local government there would be providing a financial service to persons by figuring out our property taxes for us and providing a bill and arranging for collection out of our mortgage loan escrow accounts. That seems to comply with the plain natural meaning of providing financial services to persons, whereas local government, by paying their employees at whatever rate, is acting as an employer, and what they're doing, the employee provides services to the employer, and the employer, by paying them, is, you know, simply sort of performing an enforceable legal obligation under the employment contract. So to our thinking, it is just the plain, ordinary meaning of the words, provide financial services to persons, doesn't apply to this situation. There are lots of arrows on this big piece of paper. Right, and so I understand that a 1999 Attorney General opinion came to the opposite conclusion with respect to an increase in PERS benefits for local government employees. And the problem there, if you read the opinion, is that they don't get any farther with the plain, ordinary meaning of the words. They consider it still ambiguous. And that is the most important level of interpretation, according to the Supreme Court, will be the text and context. Where the Attorney General really pushed it over was looking at the history. But the history that the Attorney General considered was the legislative history of the House Joint Resolution, by which the issue was referred to the people. And since then, the Supreme Court has said that is not the legislative history that you consider at all when you're considering a constitutional amendment that was approved by the people. Of course, they all have to be. But what you look at, history doesn't mean legislative history of the joint resolution. It means the material in the voters' pamphlet, other measures, related measures, either in the Constitution or that were voted on at the same time, or editorials, news reports. And so if you take that out in this case, if you don't look at the joint resolution at all, and that material, there is some discussion at the federal level of unfunded mandates, including minimum wage increases. But when you get down to the period when the ballot measure 30 was being discussed, there is no mention at all in local newspapers or in the voters pamphlet. There's just, they don't mention it at all. So in fact, the fact that earlier there had been discussion when there was a congressional enactment, and then 2 years later they don't mention it all at the local level, that earlier material, it becomes kind of remarkable that somehow they just didn't talk about it. So it seems that on balance, the evidence that the Supreme Court says you should consider really suggests that they were not thinking of a increase in the state minimum wage as an unfunded mandate at the time the ballot measure 30 was approved.
Thank you very much, Mr. Deal. Vice Chair Thatcher?
So, Mr. Chair, the tentative conclusion, I understand it's not definitive, conclusion is basically that the legislature can increase the costs or expenses of provision of a program as long as we're not asking them to actually increase services. I mean, it sounds like as long as we're not asking them to actually, you know, provide more service or change or increase services or what was the other thing? Come up with a new program, then it doesn't matter what we do as a legislature, we can just make it more expensive for them without having to, you know, give them an opt-out. Is that a correct interpretation of what you're saying, essentially?
Well, Chair Denbrough, Senator Thatcher, of course, I would say it's more limited. What I'm saying is, actually, it's just paying your employees isn't a program. So Article 11, Section 15 doesn't apply to the legislature increasing this state minimum wage.
Okay. So it's not a program, but it still increases expense. Yeah. And so basically what we're saying is we're going to make it more expensive for you, and citizens are not going to get an increased level of service out of it. That's really kind of what we're doing.
But
not what you're saying.
But what I would add is the fact that there isn't an increased level of service further suggests that Article 11, Section 15 doesn't apply. It's more money for the same level of service.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So let me ask you, Ellen, in your review of the history, you said there wasn't any mention of minimum wage as being a program. What would be an example of what was talked about?
Okay. Hold on.
Sorry.
Yeah,
just to help, to help us.
Since Tuesday.
Yeah.
So where is it? Right. So these are taken from the 1996 general election voters pamphlet. The examples of unfunded mandates, and these are both from arguments in favor and opposition, include requiring expansion of county jail space, appropriate public safety and quality education, requiring elections to be conducted at polling places, land use planning, county assessment of property for taxation, free access by utilities to county rights of way, education for handicapped children, local enforcement of building and fire codes, and county provision of flu shots for senior citizens. So those were all the examples I could find mentioned in the voters pamphlet.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions for LC? Okay, thank you very much. I know how busy you folks are right now. Appreciate your taking the time to help us with this.
Sure.
Thanks. So Caitlin is here. Why don't you come on up, Caitlin, if you would. Thanks. And so Caitlin is going to talk to us again, as I said, about the notion of self-sufficiency and how counties might be analyzed to get it, you know, what the various self-sufficiency levels are for them, and that general thing. I do want to say, colleagues, you have a handout on Senate Bill 1532. It relates to the dash 13s that talks a little bit about the methodology of self-sufficiency as well. Sorry. Caitlin, welcome. You could identify yourself for the record and...
Chair Dembrough, members of the committee, my name is Caitlin Baggett. I'm the executive director of the North Star Civic Foundation. Actually, I want to start by quickly giving you a little background on what our foundation does. It's my third time talking to you about data. Our foundation's relatively new. We're founded by two retired business leaders, one living in Portland and one in Kimberley, who saw that the legislative process often lacked resources for this kind of impartial analysis. I am not an economist, but have spent the majority of the last year researching this topic. When we first started doing this work, we were trying to understand the arguments being made by labor groups about increasing cost of living for Oregonians and how those increases in cost of living should result in an increase in the minimum wage. And so our first question was, well, how do we know that there are increases in cost of living, and what does that look like, and how do we go about measuring poverty? And we looked at many different indicators for cost of living. And I'm sure that over the last year, you also have been looking at many different indicators for cost of living, which sometimes seem contradictory. We hear about cost of housing in different parts of the state, and the report that came out last spring from the National Low-Income Housing Center on how quickly those costs have gone up, particularly in urban areas. But if you travel around the state, you hear about difficulties finding affordable housing in every community in Oregon. You also hear about this concept of a living wage, which is increasingly attached to some business types, B corporations, setting their own wages based on living wage, which is calculated by MIT. The self-sufficiency standard is a body of research that has been developed every year for the last 20 years. It was developed as an alternative to the federal poverty level. The federal poverty level is one way of measuring what it should cost for a family to afford the basics, but it is based on a percentage of what food should cost. And we all know the cost of food has changed a lot in the 50 years since the federal poverty level was first developed. And so the self-sufficiency looks at what people would call a different breadbasket. It looks at housing, medical care, child care, taxes, this sort of basic set, transportation, and miscellaneous expenses. And one of the positive things about the self-sufficiency standard is that it measures the actual costs of those goods and services on a county level in 37 states, and it measures it every year. And so the data that you get from the self-sufficiency standard is continually updated and has been for the last 20 years and is a measure of real costs rather than an extrapolation of food costs as the federal poverty level is. Another benefit of the self-sufficiency standard is that it really takes a more granular look at geography than the federal poverty level can. It looks on a county-by-county level and really satisfies some of the concerns that our foundation had beginning to do this research, that we were seeing single numbers for the state as a whole, and we knew that the picture was more complex than that. The other way that the self-sufficiency standard is different than other measures is that it measures these costs for 70 different family types. So it looks at the cost of living for an individual with no dependents, and it looks at the cost of living for a single parent with an infant, a single parent with
two preschool children, a family with two parents working full-time and four children at different ages, a family with two parents and dependent seniors. It's an exhaustive body of data. And as a data nerd, I really enjoyed it. The other thing to know about the self-sufficiency standard is that over the course of the last 20 years, it has been used to support many different kinds of policymaking. And so I've given you one handout that I'll walk through that shows some of how the self-sufficiency standard works, or how it looks at different families. But what I want to start with is the self-sufficiency standard in practice. The self-sufficiency standard is currently being used to better understand issues of income inadequacy and to create and analyze public policy and help individuals who are striving to meet their basic needs in many states in the country. It's been used as a tool to evaluate the impact of current and proposed policy changes, and it can be used to evaluate the impact of a variety of work supports. It has been used as a benchmark for setting wages, both in public policy and also in the state of California for actually setting the wages of their child care workers. And what the self-sufficiency standard hopes to do, or what the data supports, is looking at wage compared to cost of living and being able to understand the buying power that a given wage has in different communities across the state. Their website, they're at the University of Washington Center for Women's Welfare. Their website gives a pretty thorough overview of all the different ways that the policy has been used, from policy analysis to counseling low-income individuals to evaluating public programs to helping lawmakers to target and allocate public resources, supporting research, and also as a community indicator to help communities understand if they are growing more and more supportive of working families in their communities, or if in fact families in their communities are losing ground. So in practice, when you look at the self-sufficiency standard to get an idea of what it looks like, I've taken you through these slides before, but maybe I can zoom ahead. This is the old one, I'm sorry, it's very hard to see. And I'm not even sure. I don't think it's on this one. So I'm sorry to the. You have the handout and you can see it, but I don't think that this presentation does a good job of showing it. I apologize. So if you look at the cost of living for a single adult in Multnomah County, the self-sufficiency standard for 2014 would show it as $19,900. Whereas a single adult in Coos County would be $18,000, about $1,000 a year less. But the real difference is, sorry, it does not relate to this slide at all. Should I just turn it off? There we go. One of the key slides that I was hoping to show isn't in this presentation. Sorry, Jan, thank you. The cost of living for a single adult does not look radically different from one part of the state to another. But when you start looking at the cost of living for families, it really does. Two adults and two school-aged children in Coos County self-sufficiency standard in 2014 would have been $40,000, whereas in Multnomah County it would have been $10,000 more, representing increased costs in housing, cost of childcare, cost of basic goods and services. Any of you who've talked to me about this data in the last year know that I don't think that a single body of data should be the basis for setting our minimum wage. And the self-sufficiency standard, although our foundation chose it above all the other options, above the cost of housing, above the living wage standard, and we did so, I think, for good reasons, this body of data, I want to be clear, also has its limitations. It is, although it's analyzed on a county-by-county basis, it really does not show differences within a county in cost of living, right? So this body of data does a great job of showing what's happening in Multnomah County, where it is an urban county throughout the county. It does a great job of showing what's happening in truly rural counties where the whole county is rural. But what the data will show you in a county where there's a large urban center and a very rural county really is a reflection of what's happening at the urban center. And so that's one limitation of this body of data. Another is that it is an extremely modest cost of living. The self-sufficiency standard includes no allowance for savings, for an emergency, for paying off debt, for going to the movies. It is the most modest cost of living data that we could find. So we see that as a limitation. It truly is an expression of what a family of a certain size needs to earn to pay their own bills with no public or private support in every county in Oregon. And that is really all it does. We have not had a chance in the last 24 hours to evaluate the -13 amendment compared to the self-sufficiency standard on a county-by-county basis. But I can give you a little bit of an idea of what it looks like to me. It's pretty similar to some modeling that I did this winter. But again, I haven't looked county by county. But what I expect that I'll see over the weekend when I do compare it county by county is that in every county in Oregon, an individual with no dependents will rise to a level of self-sufficiency by 2022 under this proposal. That is a significant win. That is not the case for Oregon right now. I expect that what I will also see is that in counties that have an urban center and are rural in the rest of the county, that the self-sufficiency data will show that families with a couple of dependents who are not in child care, that in three or four counties, those families will still struggle. That in the most rural counties, we'll see families move up to a level of self-sufficiency, but that in counties that are a mix of rural and urban, we will still see some families at 80 to 90% of self-sufficiency, particularly in the places that we know are the most expensive places to live. I also expect that what we'll see is that in every county in the state, families who have children in childcare will still be far below any self-sufficiency level. Our research throughout the year has showed that minimum wage is not the right tool for addressing the high costs of childcare throughout Oregon, and that there isn't a way to calibrate the wage that addresses those costs. I want to get back to the single set of data problem. When I first started doing this work about a year ago, modeling different ways of setting the wage regionally in Oregon, I plugged four different sets of data into a series of maps and had a moment where I looked at Tillamook County, and in one version they got a 25-cent raise in Tillamook County, and another they didn't. And I thought, this is a really weighty thing, right? How do you decide whether or not a group of workers in a county earn another $500 in a year or not based on a single set of data? I can't advise it. To make sound public policy in this area, you need to also look at racial equity. You also need to look at increasing costs of living through time. And you also need to look at the median income in that area. I'm happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you, Caitlin. Colleagues, any questions? Yes, Vice Chair Thatcher, please.
And yeah, thank you. Addressing the child care costs,
yeah.
It seems like that with the minimum wage would also increase the costs of child care at the same time. And I'm wondering if things like that, like costs of food, mm-hmm. costs of transportation, because of the minimum wage, you know, after that, how much is that going to impact that self-sufficiency mm-hmm. Level? Was that taken into consideration?
It was and it wasn't. And so... In our projections of cost of living between now and 2022, we included an annual percentage increase of 2.8% for cost of goods and services. That's above the cost of living increases that we've seen in some parts of the state, and it takes into account some increases that we might see with an increase in the minimum wage. In general, the increase in the minimum wage has a very modest impact on goods and services outside of food. And in our report that we put together, rural perspectives on minimum wage and regional economies, there's an analysis in the back on the kinds of increases on cost of goods and services that you could expect. And I can tell you that it's very, very modest. It's for a 10% increase in the wage, obviously does not result in a 10% increase in costs. It's not carried over on a dollar-by-dollar basis in that way. It's a 0.4% per 10% increase for most goods and services. It's very, very small. For food, it is a bit higher, and that information is here. So, sorry for my yes and no answer. But
so basically, over a broad set of goods and services, it's point four for every 10% increase?
Chair Dembrough, members of the committee, it's complicated. It's 0.4% per 10% of increase.
Per 10% of increase, yeah, okay. Which means it could be higher, much lower in, you know, different sectors, I suppose, in that group of basic services. The six or eight different things you price? Okay, what was it? Assumes the full cost of each basic need, and there were how many?
So there's
six basic needs. Got it. Okay. Got it.
Any other questions, colleagues? Okay. Thank you very much, Caitlin. Really appreciate it. Okay. So is this all? Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay. So I don't have to close anything. I'll just.
You're going to open a public hearing?
Yeah. Okay. So at this time, we're ready for our public hearing on Senate Bill 1532. We have a sign-up sheet. People have signed up. I'm going to call people up in the order in which they signed up. No pro-con kind of thing. Some of you may be having to be sworn in because this year some of the vice chairs are requesting that individuals who are testifying before us be sworn in. What we did yesterday in this committee was we required that requirement be limited to those who are representing public agencies or who are registered lobbyists here at the Capitol, and that other citizens would not need to be sworn in. So as you come up as panels, I'll ask you if you are a registered lobbyist or are representing a public agency. So before we do that, I do have instructions to witnesses to explain the effects of the oath. We have been reading this every time that we're in this kind of situation, and this requirement, by the way, is in Oregon statute. Oregon's legislature is one of the most open and inclusive in the nation. We hold public hearings on each of our bills and seek input from the public in our committee process. We depend on the information provided to us by the citizens of Oregon. No one can tell us better how the laws we pass affect the people of our state. All we expect in return for your help is that you respect the members of this committee, respect the legislative process, and that you tell us the truth. Whether you are another member of the Legislative Assembly, the director of an agency, a lobbyist, or a member of the general public, we expect for your testimony to be truthful. However, I am concerned that the practice of swearing in witnesses will have a chilling effect on the willingness of everyday Oregonians to participate in the process of making their laws. For that reason, I want to address those of you planning on coming before this committee today. And I will add, I suspect it's for that reason that our vice chair has asked us not to swear in members of the general public. The vice chair, chair of the committee is within her rights to ask that you be sworn in. However, you have rights too. You don't have to swear an oath. You can walk away if you choose. You can choose to have an attorney present with you. You can avail yourself of your Fifth Amendment rights, including the right not to give testimony against yourself. And if you tell the truth, nothing you say to this committee, whether you have sworn an oath or not, can be used against you in any state proceeding. You should know, however, that this immunity does not extend to any federal legal proceeding that may be brought against you, including a federal criminal proceeding. If you testify under oath and do not tell the truth, you could be charged with the crime of perjury. Perjury is a Class C felony and carries a maximum possible sentence of 5 years imprisonment, a $125,000 fine, or both. It is up to the Marion County District Attorney, however, whether to proceed with any charges for perjury. Okay, so with that, I will call up my first panel. Anna Scharf, Matt Cyrus, and Bill Brawley, if you would come up, please. Okay, Ms. Scharf, Mr. Cyrus, Mr. Brawley, welcome. You're very welcome here. Are any of you a registered lobbyist with this body or representing a public agency?
No.
A few more days, I might need to register as a lobbyist.
I think I might be on one of the entities that I sit on the board on.
That's fine, as long as it's not a public agency. Okay, Ms. Scharf, welcome.
Thank you. Chair Dembro and members of the committee, my name is Anna Scharf, and I'm here on behalf of Scharf Farms, Inc. in Polk County. I am back again to urge a no vote on Senate Bill 1532, as well as all the proposed various amendments. Tuesday, I described the jobs that will be eliminated on my family farm and how automation will replace those positions. Today, I want to talk about the other jobs that will be lost. This morning, I was sitting in Corvallis as a trustee on the Oregon 4-H board, working on ways to help the youth in our state. I excused myself from that meeting so that I could come here and tell you about how this legislation will hurt those kids. Higher wages do not equal employment opportunities for youth. On the way here, I spoke with my school district business manager about how a higher minimum wage increase will affect the small rural school board that I sit on. How an increase in the minimum wage plus sick time plus the PERS hit coming, the Affordable Care Act, etc., will equal no additional benefits or money in the classroom. I also spoke with my Polk County Fairgrounds manager. I asked her how, as her board member, I'll be able to make policy changes and pricing changes needed to mitigate a minimum wage increase, and more importantly, how many summertime youth positions I will have to cut at the county fair. I thought the short session was about fixing and clarifying legislation passed during the last session or by interim ballot measures, fixes such as those created by the legalization of marijuana and mandatory sick time. I thought it was time to work on budget tweaks. I didn't think it was time to rush through cumbersome Dash 19 amendments. Finally, please think about the wedge that this bill and these amendments will continue to create between the rural and urban divide in this state. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Scharf.
Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Matt Cyrus. I reside in Sisters, Oregon. And I didn't come with a prepared statement. I wasn't aware of this hearing until I got here today for some other issues, but I'd certainly encourage you to not support these increases. We have a small family farm, but in addition to, in order to help subsidize the farm, our family owns a family-owned golf course and have a restaurant over in the Sisters area. And currently, we hire probably close to a dozen school-age students every year. We give them opportunity for first-time jobs, and they all start out at minimum wage, and as they learn to do their work, do their jobs, certainly graduate them up, teach them how to work, give them life skills, abilities that they can then take on and go elsewhere, plus gives them a little income while they're going to school. If these minimum wages are increased, bottom line is we won't be able to afford to hire students anymore. We're going to have to be looking at hiring experienced employees that have the skill set already in place. And quite frankly, I'm not sure who can afford to take the time to hire these guys. You know, we have kids that we hire to run the carts on the golf course. We have bussers in the restaurant. On the restaurant side, quite frankly, we may be forced to close the restaurant, which right now we employ somewhere in the neighborhood of 40 to 50 people. Our servers, we typically pay a little more than minimum wage, but when they include their tips, they take home somewhere in the neighborhood of $20 an hour, which is significantly more than minimum wage. But our cost side will go up to the point where we'll no longer be feasible. I've run the numbers based on the proposed increase in minimum wage. It works out to roughly a 20% increase in our menu prices just on the labor side. And I don't think in our area the market will bear that kind of an increase. I would, like I say, I would certainly encourage you guys not to go here. It seems that the best way to raise wages is to increase job opportunities, and competition for good employees will raise the prices by themselves. Thank you.
Mr. Borelli.
Chairman, members of the committee, thanks for the opportunity to speak here this afternoon. My name is Bill Brawley. I'm the owner of Greenbrier Ag Management, which is a Christmas tree company that has farms here in Marion County and several other counties here in the state. We employ between 200 and 300 people throughout the year, just depending on the season. And we average somewhere in the middle of that range on a fairly consistent basis. Payroll is one of our largest line items in our company. It's as large a line item as all the others combined. So it's very substantial in our operating expenses. If payroll's increased, of course, there's other things go along with it as well. Payroll taxes, your unemployment, workman's comp, all that's a percentage rate that's tied to your wages. And we work in an industry that's very competitive and has been competitive for a number of years. And pricing is very competitive to go along with that. We work on very narrow margins, and an increase in labor will affect our ability to maintain our business and to employ the people that we employ. Um, 2015, the same as any other years in the past, we establish our pricing, our competitive pricing, based on known costs that we had against the product that we're producing. And we manufactured our worked with our product along those lines. That was part of our game plan for the year, our business model. And to ask us to, or any company or any person, to go back and pay a cost that increases on a product that's already been sold, there's no opportunity to increase the price on that product, will be catastrophic for our business and very unfair. And even if we had time to adjust to that change, our industry would not be able to withstand an increase in minimum wage as proposed. I also looked at the regional system and have felt that this is difficult to work with. It gives an unfair or an advantage or disadvantage to people depending on which region they're in. We're in the same industry. We deal with the same pricing. We deal with the same customer base. And to have a major line item like payroll that's affected just by the region that you're in is going to be very, very difficult to work with. So based on those things, I urge you to vote no on the wage increase and help us to maintain the level of people that we employ in this county and this state, and help us to continue to do that. Thank you.
Thank you very much for those remarks, Mr. Rowley. Thank you, all three of you. Our next panel is Mitch Teal, Christine Dyker, and Gloria Jones, please. Dyker. Okay, so are any of you representing public agencies or registered lobbyists with this body?
No, sir.
Chamber of Commerce. It's not public.
Okay, great. Then, Mr. Teal, why don't you start off?
All right. Thank you, Chair Demarro and committee. My name is Mitch Teal. I own three businesses here in Oregon, and I'm here today to urge you to vote no. The proposal, and I just learned about this, and so I just basically walked in the door at 1 o'clock, so I'm going to skip around a little bit, but I did jot down some points that I want to make very clear as far as my opinion. Recently, with fee increases, with the Medical Leave Act, with a lot of different things that are targeting small businesses specifically, it's been very damaging. And a minimum wage increase at this point, especially at a time when the economy is not doing very well, when discretionary income is at a very low point, you know, trying to extend the minimum wage to a higher level, that puts a huge burden on small businesses. You cannot squeeze one more dollar of discretionary income out of the people in the economy at this point. So increasing the minimum wage is going to create a huge burden on small businesses. You know, it creates in a small business, in all business, the inability to pay the best workers. When you're talking about entry-level positions where you're paying a minimum wage, as in my business, I used to employ 15 to 20 people when the economy was doing better. Now I'm about 9 to 10 people. I would love to employ more people, but that's not going to be possible if the minimum wage increases. In fact, it may be that I may have to reduce the number of people. It creates the inability to pay the most valuable employees. So right now, I don't have any employees that are making minimum wage. They all make more than minimum wage because, well, they start out making minimum wage, but I train them. I give them valuable tools that they're going to carry on with them throughout their lifetime. They're going to take these to different positions. I provide a lot to these people that I employ. I love these people. They're some of my best friends. And as I increase their wages, the minimum wage increases, all of a sudden, you know, their wages aren't, they don't have the buying power that they had previously, and they don't have the status. They're going to be making more similar and similar to the people who are just now entering the workforce. That is not equality. You know, I mentioned I have three businesses now. I've been wanting to start several other businesses, but I'm completely putting that on hold. The chilling effect that this type of action is taking on small businesses is substantial. And progress and growth is slowing because of the fear of business owners in this community. I heard something mentioned earlier, the fact that in all likelihood, I will be hiring less people and making them work harder as a necessity because the products and services that I sell, you know, are, which a lot of businesses are dependent on discretionary income. If there is no more discretionary income, I cannot raise my prices to cover that cost. So something has to give. And that would be employment opportunities for people who are desiring minimum wage jobs. Go to the second one here. One thing that I've noticed as fees and restrictions and burdens and minimum wage increases is that there's huge opportunities for big corporations and franchises to come into our local communities because they're the ones that can absorb that type of expense. And so we're losing our local flavor, we're losing our local businesses, we're becoming homogenized across the country. And you can see that here in Salem, you can see it all over the state. Small mom and pops diners are leaving at record rates. Franchises, Kentucky Fried Chickens, Taco Bells are popping up everywhere. And that's going to be the and they're going to be automating. So that's going to be a continuing issue. I've heard some talk about how the cost of living, you know, is not affected much by the minimum wage increase. That's just not how it works. The minimum wage increases as the supply of money in the economy increases, the cost of goods and sold goes up. It's a direct relationship. And most businesses cannot compete with that. I cannot charge more for my product and services. Or if you have a product and service that you can charge more, you're going to make up for that minimum wage increase. For example, milk, Christmas trees, rent, those things are all going to go up as minimum wage goes up because you have to hire people. You have to hire people to truck that stuff, to move that merchandise, to manage that property. All those things are going to go up. That's going to cost. It's minimum wage has increased many times, and we still haven't reached a level that, you know, people would consider a living wage, or I can't remember the phrase that was being used earlier, but it's not meant to be a living wage. It's meant to be a minimum wage, an entry-level job where they earn skills to develop, to use later in life, to increase their skills, and to be competitive and earn more money. So I urge you to vote no on this. It's detrimental to small business and the Oregon economy and the ability for people to find work. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Teal.
And thank you, Chair Dumbrell. I'm Christine Deeker, the Executive Director of the Kaiser Chamber of Commerce, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak kind of a little more casually now and not really rushed, but I will try and be to the point in what I have to say as representative of 386 members of the Chamber of Commerce in Kaiser. And I've been that executive director now for close to 18 years. And what I have seen over those 18 years is our membership levels parallels economy, and economy that is vital, and economy that went into the dumper when we went through the recession. We were up to about 425 at one time. Then at the recession, boom, there it goes. And the point I'm trying to make along those lines is that now at 385, we're getting there. We're getting back up to an economy that jobs are created and living wage jobs are created. But what I've been hearing from our members and from our small businesses is now with this increase in minimum wage, they don't want to expand. They don't want to come to Kaiser. I can't tell you that the reason why we have two large empty spaces in Kaiser that used to be grocery stores, I can't tell you that nobody's coming in there because of the threat of minimum wage being $15 or $13 an hour. But if I had that money to invest and open up a grocery store to hire our young people again in Kaiser, I don't think I could be profitable and I don't think I would do it. That's the scare that I hear from our businesses. I have our farmers right north of us. I've testified before that they cannot compete. Shriners Iris Gardens, they hire 22 year-round employees and then up to 160 during their harvest season. During the harvest season, they put people to work that hand-pick the irises out of the ground and hand take them and prepare them for delivery and whatnot. They're not going to survive if this minimum wage goes up. And this is a 90-year-long family business that is worried about surviving. I also have testimony from members that it's the same old story. They'll either have to raise their prices, and that's going to hurt the trickle-down effect of the cost of living is going to go up, or they'll have to eliminate jobs, which is the one thing I'm just the most afraid of, is the lack of jobs. I guess in closing, it's very, very important that you discern every part of the outcomes of this increase, this drastic increase. And I thank you for your diligence in doing that, and I just hope that you keep it the way it is at a cost of living increase, which I think is fair. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Deeker. Ms. Jones, welcome.
Good afternoon. I don't really, I'm kind of surprised I'm
here.
Could
you give us your name, please, for the record, Ms. Jones?
And my name is Gloria Jones. I'm probably the oldest member here today as a senior citizen, and so I guess that's why I'm here. My husband and I have worked many years, 50 plus, to think that we would be in a pretty good shape when we retired. And he has gone. He is now no longer with us. But I am here as a single senior citizen on a fixed income. The retirement that I thought I had with everything else is in this world, going up and down and everything else, is now my advisor says, well, you better not plan on living much longer, Gloria, because you're running out of money. So this is just an up and down thing. Either the taxes go up, the expenses go up, and then and it's just got to be a different way of doing things than what we seem to be doing. Now, these small businessmen cannot live on what, I mean, they can't make money, they can't pay wages. But it seems to me, why would a young person just barely getting his first job, why would they be required to get this minimum wage of $15 an hour? I didn't get it. It just seems to me like there's got to be different levels. But anyway, I am against this new way. I just was reading that Oregon has one of the most highest minimum wage, and I don't understand. And I will be try my best to get more knowledgeable in some of these things. So I do appreciate the opportunity of coming here before this wonderful part of our government. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Jones, and we really appreciate your coming.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, all three of you. Okay, our final panel is Melissa Unger and Tim Cowan, please. And Melissa, I know that you are indeed a registered lobbyist.
Yes, I am a registered lobbyist.
And Mr. Cowan, I don't believe that you are.
I am not, sir.
Nor representing a government body.
I am not.
Or agency.
You know. No, sir.
you can chill for a moment while Ms. Unger raises her right hand, please.
Please raise your right hand and say, no, don't repeat, I'm sorry. Under penalty of perjury, do you solemnly swear that the evidence you are about to give in the matter now pending before the Senate Committee on Workforce and General Government shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God?
I do.
Okay, welcome both of you. Okay, Melissa, you signed up first, so you go first.
Oh, good. Chair Dimbro, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Melissa Unger, and I'm the political director for SEIU Local 503. I'm here to talk about the Dash 13 amendments that are before you today. I know there's lots of other amendments. I'm going to try to focus on those ones. I think, as I mentioned Tuesday briefly, I think there is you know, if we were here today discussing our proposal, we would be the most excited, which was 1350 by 2018 and lifting preemption. Clearly, we were way past that. And so moving on from that, we want to talk about the proposal that we were talking about today. First, we do think that there are some good things in this proposal. We do believe that there's a meaningful raise, 50 cents this summer for somebody who did not get a CPI increase this year if they're working full time is $10.50 a year, which when you're talking about people who are struggling to make ends meet, paying bills or having increasing rents, that amount of money is really meaningful. And to be honest, it is an important part of this proposal, we think, for workers, is that for many of them, that will be the biggest raise that they have seen in some time. And we believe that's really important. We also believe that some of the numbers in the Metro Portland UGB, which gets to $14.75 in 6 years, or $13.50 as a statewide wage in many of the areas, are really huge steps forward. While, as I said earlier, we would prefer other things sometimes, like a quicker phase-in, we do believe that those numbers are meaningful for workers, can be life-changing, and for many people who go to work every day, will allow them to pay bills, allow them to make sure that they feel like they can put food on their table and a roof over their family's head. And we also appreciate that there's been lots of talk about looking at cost of living in the different regions as a way to look at this issue. Now, let's be clear, $14.75 in Portland does not get anywhere close to the self-sufficiency standards that Caitlin was talking about earlier. I think Washington County and Clackamas County have the highest self-sufficiency wages in the state, over $22. And as she noted, those self-sufficiency wages don't take into account anything beyond paying basic bills. And so we're not meeting those standards across the board, and we're also meeting those standards in 6 years, where as everything goes up, those self-sufficiency standards will also go up. But we also recognize that this is progress for workers. We do believe that in the Dash 13s there are unintended consequences, and our partners here who are a part of the Raise a Wage Coalition, Pacoon and Kausa, were not able to come and testify, and so I did want to make sure we noted some of the unintended consequences of adding a third region, I think they're being called. We completely understand the desire to help rural communities. Of our 65,000 members at SEIU, Local 503 and 49, we have many of our members who live in rural communities. But we don't believe that necessarily propping up rural communities has to come at the expense of workers. And so we do continue to have some concerns that people would be paid $12.50 in rural communities. Also, some of the communities that are on the third region list actually have some of the highest percentage of people of color in the entire state. Jefferson, Malheur, and Morrow counties, by percentage, are the highest percent of people of color by county in the state, closely followed by Umatilla. And also, many of those workers there are farm workers. And while we know that this proposal does bring in a lot of farm workers and lift wages for a lot of farm workers, it also does leave many out. And so, you know, as we look at this in terms of how we move our state forward, we think there are good things in this bill. We also have concerns about the third region for the moment, for the reasons we highlighted. And so I want to thank you for your time. I want to thank people who have worked very hard on this bill. Yeah, that's what I got.
Thank you very much, Melissa.
No problem.
Mr. Cowan.
Chair Denborough, Vice Chair Thatcher, committee members, for the record, my name is Tim Cowan. Hopefully this testimony demonstrates my respect to the minimum wage. The minimum wage was designed to establish a beginning point or a start of a work career. When I first entered the work environment, I worked for a dairy as a sophomore. That was not what I wanted to do for a career. I started as a pizza cook, Montgomery Ward's, Western Auto. And as a result of that, I continued to try to move my career along. I usually worked at two jobs at a time. I learned to postpone the things I wanted, or I made the choice to postpone the things I wanted until I could afford it, whether it was marriage, kids, buying cars, houses, or anything else until I could afford it. So I have a summary and then one remaining issue. When did I or you accept the responsibility to be a parent? When did I or you accept the responsibility for someone's choices? How many that testify for an increase is a matter of supporting the choices they make. Now, the increase of the minimum wage, I'm concerned about the impact on those with fixed income. When you talk about the cost of living and everything else going up, it's that for fixed and more. I worked, and then when I was about, I'm going to go about 60 years old, I slipped and fell and lost everything I had as a result of that, and it does restrict some of my ability to work. So there's an increase to the cost of living. If I want to use myself as an example, it's medical. My investment values have went down with the stock market. I lose the ability to have access to cash because a lot of my investments are in things that don't turn fast. For example, my house. My house has lower value, and if I need the money and sell it, I'm going to have to take less. So as my ability to increase my income and in some degree work, my ability to increase my investments isn't there. So I would like you to consider the impact on the cost of living that increase in minimum wage would have on those on fixed income. I describe them as the looming poor. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Cowan. Okay, thank you, both of you. Okay, colleagues, with that, I'm going to close this public hearing on Senate Bill 1532, and I'm going to open our work session on 1532, initially for the consideration of amendments, but we have received the LFO and LRO, our legislative fiscal analysis, and our legislative revenue analysis of the dash 13s anyway, so if we do decide to move those, the bill with those in it today, we can do so. So why don't we start off with the bills that Jan presented today. Senator Thatcher, would you like to have us take them up?
Well, I would actually, you know, go ahead and adopt yours, and we can go after that. That's fine. Both the 13s that you're planning to do?
Happy to do so. Okay. Would you like to make the motion to adopt those, Senator Thatcher?
I would prefer not to, actually. Would you like to do that, Senator Rosenbaum?
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I move the dash 13 amendments to Senate Bill 1532.
Okay, Senator Rosenbaum moves that we adopt the dash 13 amendments to Senate Bill 1532. Those were dated February 4th, 2016. Okay, any discussion of the dash 13? So you all remember that that's the one that sets the three regions. We discussed them and took questions on them yesterday. Are there any comments or questions initially about them? Senator Rosenbaum.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I would like to clarify something for the record, and I'll point to, I think, the lines that this language occurs in this dash 13 version. And on, let's see, on page 2, on line 6, and again on line 22, is the phrase, if the employer is located, and then on line 6 it's within the urban growth boundary, and on line 22, it's if the employer is located within a non-urban county. And I would like to clarify for the record what that means, because there could be some ambiguity, and I'm just thinking of an employer, I don't know, Fred Meyer's or Les Schwab Tires, that have locations all over the state. I'd like to get a clarification of whether we're talking about where the employee reports for work, which could be one of numerous locations. That's what I think is the intent of the employer is located versus the employer's headquarters or something like that.
Thanks for that question, Senator. Yeah, you know, first of all, I want to be very clear that we're not talking about the headquarters of the business, which could be, you know, very far from where the individual worker works or lives. You know, I've been thinking, the other day I gave you the example of a somebody who works for a landscaping company, but I want to use the example of a company that I know is very dear to my colleague to the left, and that is Les Schwab, because of their recent service to her. So if somebody is working for Les Schwab, and, I, you know, actually, I don't know if Les Schwab does road service, but let's imagine they do. So
if you break down in front of them after they're closed, they do. That's my Les Schwab story.
Right. So, you know, I'm not sure where the headquarters is. The headquarters still at, in Prineville?
It's in Bend.
It's in Bend now, yes. They saw the light, right, Senator?
They moved the headquarters, but they still have substantial presence in Prineville.
Okay, great. So it's certainly not, you know, if somebody is working for Les Schwab here in Salem, they are, you know, that the employer location is not Bend. It would be Salem. And even if they did road service, even more amazing that they did for Senator Gelzer, and actually went to an area inside the urban growth boundary of Portland, the metro area, even though they did the work there, that is not their employer location. It's that Salem, Les Schwab, where they work. And we decided that, you know, again, for the sake of simplicity and predictability, both for employer and employee, we want to create stability here. And so that's why, that's the standard that's intended by this language. Does that help, Senator?
So it is where the employee reports for work. That is the meaning of the employer is located.
That's correct.
Okay.
Any other questions about the...
Pledge Council must have been listening to
it. Yeah, so, but I don't know. Do you, folks, do you feel like you need further clarification on that point?
No, Mr. Chair, but my understanding was is that it was the headquarters, so.
No, it is definitely not the headquarters. We would have used that term if that's what was the intent was. Okay, great. Discussion of these Dash 13 amendments then. Okay, it's Corey, I think you better call the roll on this one.
Senator Gelzer?
Aye.
Senator Knope?
No.
Senator Rosenbaum?
Aye.
Vice Chair Thatcher?
No.
Chair Dembro?
Aye. The motion passes, and these Dash 13 amendments are adopted.
And Mr. Chair, yes. See, the reason the Dash 19s and the Dash, well, I don't have a list of
actually,
the
all
17s
of them.
And all that were, I mean, if we are, there, so if we're going to go forward with such a thing, then... that's where the Dash 17, well, I'll leave with that one. That one creates a refundable tax credit since we're going to be going down the road of increasing this wage. And if it's a great state policy, kind of like the sick leave bill, I just say, you know, let's have a a tax credit to help alleviate the additional costs that will be imposed in complying with this.
So therefore,
I move the dash 17s to Senate Bill, what is it?
1532. Okay. Vice Chair Thatcher 32. Has moved the dash 17 amendments to Senate Bill 1532. Discussion? Senator Thatcher?
I said.
Okay.
Just one more time, can you explain what they do?
Well, okay, what it would
so
do.
So 17.
Dash 17 would be the refundable tax credit.
Is that right, or is that?
That's correct.
And okay. It keeps the same wage levels and the same phase in period that are in the dash 13s. It adds the refundable tax credit for the increased labor costs due to the minimum wage.
Okay. And so the cost of the increased wage would come out of the general fund, presumably.
Presumably.
Any further discussion? Okay, Corey, would you call the roll on, again, this is the dash 17 amendments.
Senator Gelser?
Yeah. No.
Senator Knopes?
Aye.
Senator Rosenthal?
No.
Vice Chair Thatcher?
Aye.
Chair Dembro?
No. The motion fails.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash 16 amendment to Senate Bill 1532.
Okay. Senator Knope has moved the dash 16 amendments to Senate Bill 1532. And these are the employer size one. Is that right?
It is. This amendment would exempt employers of less than 50 employees from the increase in this particular bill.
Any discussion of this amendment, Senator?
Sure, Mr. Chair. Thank you. So we heard a lot of testimony from especially rural Oregon that the scale of the increase and the way it's being implemented makes them uncompetitive in a number of areas, including pretty much all ag. Because they don't control the prices, even if they wanted to raise prices, they can't raise prices. Raising prices to them is essentially saying we're going out of business because they don't set the prices. The prices are basically dictated on a world market basis. So a lot of these companies are less than 50. I recognize that this doesn't include everybody, but the unfortunate part of a significant minimum wage increase like this is it actually benefits large multinational corporations over small businesses because small businesses don't have a way to spread the cost amongst all their locations because they probably only have one location. And a large multinational corporation can spread that across the world in terms of their cost increase versus small business. So very damaging to small business. And so that is the reason for the amendment.
Thank you. Just one thing, I just want to make is, you know, what we learned in our discussion of sick leave last year, where we learned so much, you know, one of the things that we learned was that in agriculture, here in Oregon, increasingly the labor is being provided through labor contractors, you know, many of whom are larger than 50, and so a very large percentage of agriculture would actually not benefit from this.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, many of these farming operations, though, have permanent employees that aren't on farm labor contracts that they try to keep working year-round, and their ability to continue to do that, I think, is going to be, I think, impacted pretty dramatically. And so this is really just an accommodation because although I do appreciate the fact that we're taking into account regions, I've been to all 36 counties in Oregon multiple times, and what you see in rural Oregon is not what you see in Portland or in Washington County or in Clackamas County or even in Corvallis, which I go to frequently as well. And so in order, I mean, the emails that we've gotten, the testimony that we received from rural Oregon is that they're fighting for their very survival in this. And so I think this extra step would be helpful, I think, for them to try to compete against both other states nationally and then worldwide, because I just don't think that at this time they're going to be able to withstand the increase in the minimum wage. And I think it's a, for some of them, it's going to mean an end to operations. I think over time you're going to see more of that than initially. But I do think that there's going to be enough of an impact that this is well worth consideration.
Thank you, Senator. Any further discussion of the Dash 16s? Okay. Corey, would you call the roll, please?
Senator Gelser?
No.
Senator Knope?
Aye.
Senator Rosenbaum?
No.
Vice Chair Thatcher?
Aye.
Chair Denbrough?
No. The motion fails. Senator Thatcher, you will.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to move the Dash 19 amendments to Senate Bill 1532.
Vice Chair Thatcher has moved the Dash 13 amendments.
19.
I'm sorry, 19 amendments.
No, not the 13.
to Senate Bill 1532. And we did discuss this before. Do you have anything additional?
Yeah,
thanks.
Well, just... We heard from legislative council, and we know that local governments are struggling to make ends meet just, you know, as it stands, and then with regular PERS costs in addition. This is just going to exacerbate that issue for local governments. I mean, we've talked about businesses, but, you know, schools being able to provide the same level of service to their students and local governments being able to provide, you know, police services, fire service, whatever, you know, pay for the services that they have. It will be aggravated. I mean, we've essentially been told, but this is what I kind of heard from the legislative council, is that as long as we're not asking them to provide more service to the citizens, we can make it more expensive for them to provide their current services and without allowing for an opt-out. So that would be taken care of with the Dash 19s. It would allow local governments to opt out of this and maintain the path, the trajectory we're on for minimum wage increases by leaving it at what it is now and then letting the CPI index do its thing, like we've done since what year we passed that, I don't remember, but what we've been doing for the past several years, and just maintain that program for the minimum wage.
Okay. And so just to clarify, and the amendment's buried in my file, but so does the way this, the so this just gives, it kind of exempts local governments and the non-government businesses within them,
Mr. Chair, it was intended to allow local governments to take an action through their city councils or their county commission to, or their school boards, whatever, to opt out of participation.
Irrespective of any assumed rights that they have under that ballot measure?
I'm not sure. Are you talking about the Section 15 debate that we've had?
Yeah.
Is that what you're referring to? Just to clarify that exists, because it sounds like there might be some, even though legislative council has stated that it might not apply, it's not real clear, it's not definitive, and I think there could be court actions, and that would kind of stave something like that off if those counties and cities and local governments that did not want to participate in this increased or, you know, new regime for increasing the minimum wage, they would be able to opt out, and it would clarify. It would save those court costs, if nothing else. So there you go.
Thank you. Any further discussion of the Dash 19s? Okay, seeing none, Corey, could you call the roll, please?
Senator Gelser?
No.
Senator Knope?
Aye.
Senator Rosenbaum?
No.
Vice Chair Thatcher?
Aye.
Chair Denbrough?
No. The motion fails. Okay, Senator Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move Senate Bill 1532 as amended to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Okay, Senator Rosenbaum has moved Senate Bill 1532 as amended to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Discussion.
Mr. Chair, is there a fiscal on this? I see the impact. I haven't seen a fiscal.
Yeah, it's before you in your pile.
It is, yes.
Yeah, Jan, you want to summarize it for us?
Oh, my.
In general, it says that it doesn't have to go to LFO or...
Well, yeah. LFO has made it clear that they are not asking for a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. We've just put on the record the last paragraph reading. Agencies and local governments also raise a number of issues of core consideration, including the effect on the salaries of other employees who are making slightly above minimum wage, often referred to as salary compression, the potential for increased contractor costs and increased prices for services and supplies, and pressure in the collective bargaining process, and changes in eligibility for benefits or assistance. The indirect costs that may be incurred due to these and other potential issues are also indeterminate.
So essentially, is it saying that there will be increased costs? We just can't figure out how to even get our arms wrapped around how much it'll be? Is that kind of another way of saying that?
Yeah, well, it's...
go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say that the costs to, again, quoting from, and in this case, the second paragraph of the analysis, the cost to increase the minimum wage as provided in the bill is indeterminate because it is impossible to know exactly how many people in state and local government will be in positions paying less than that amount by the time the minimum wage increase is phased in. And again, remember, this is, you know, it goes up 50 cents a year or whatever. They are, I think, largely working off of that quick analysis that they did, which was handed to us, the report that was given to us. Was that yesterday? Tuesday.
Tuesday, and was exhibited for
right.
The committee.
Yeah.
Really?
33.39. Okay. Would any of the members like to make any comments before we vote?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, this may not be a surprise to you, but I am going to vote no on this particular measure. And we've had a lot of testimony. I don't know about you guys, but I've received over 1,000 emails. Now, granted, most of those are kind of robo-generated emails and have the same tagline, but nonetheless, it shows an interest by people in a certain issue. The only other issue that matches that this session is leave my guns alone emails that we receive, and I've received about 1,000 of those as well. But no other issue really even comes close to that. So clearly, the public is attuned and interested to the issue. But when you look at the areas that I represent, and no one on this panel really represents Eastern Oregon, probably I come the closest just because I'm on the other side of the mountains. But I really feel like the impact on this is going to be negative in a lot of ways. I think it's going to hurt some of the very people that you're trying to help. For instance, I talked to a daycare provider in my district, and she said for every 30 or for every 50 cent increase in the minimum wage, that's a $50 a month increase for daycare per child. So if you have two children and you're making minimum wage and you're having daycare, you're actually losing money because, you know, that $50 a month would be $600 a year times two, that's $1,200. That is larger than the increase of $1,000 roughly that they're going to get. So they go negative. Senior citizens didn't get a COLA increase this year with their Social Security, but and by law, neither did people who make the minimum wage, because the CPI didn't go above a certain level. But we're going to go ahead and make the determination that we're going to give an increase to minimum wage workers, again, many of who are teenagers in the 16 to 24-year-old range, and we're going to increase costs. And seniors on fixed incomes have, as we heard today in testimony today, have no way to make that up. I mean, I don't think any of us expect 75-year-old parents or 85-year-old grandparents to go work at this new higher minimum wage to offset their costs that they're incurring for their care, their medicine, their food, what have you. And there's no question that that those things are going to go up. It's inevitable. And I'm not aware of any other state that has taken this far this fast their minimum wage. So in, you know, I put it together a chart just for myself, yeah, of minimum wages, and so these aren't states, but Seattle's at 13, San Francisco at 13, Mountain View, California at 11. There's several in the 10, Chicago 10.50, Portland, Maine 10.10. Fast food workers in New York City apparently 10.50, but everybody else in New York is 9.75, I think, or actually $9 right now. So Oregon probably isn't the most liberal or progressive state in the country, yet no other state has done what we're going to do. I suspect there's a reason for that. We heard from small business that they really have three options, and multiple times we've heard this, and a lot of the emails that I've received include this too. If I have teenage employees, I'm no longer going to be able to afford that. We heard that in testimony today. So it's going to have a negative impact on youth employment for sure. I think in the minority community, it will have an even bigger impact. The interest in automation in order to survive. Businesses have indicated that they're going to automate. Maybe they would have anyway, but this actually makes it almost a certainty that they'll do what they can to automate, to try to be competitive, try to stay competitive. Another option we've heard is that we're not going to be profitable anymore and we have to shut down. I don't see how any of those are going to be positive for the group that we're trying to affect. What would be more positive would be the earned income tax credit that directly affects those people without raising prices, by the way. And so I think there are better ways to impact the working poor than this particular legislation or ballot measure. I get the fear of a ballot measure. I think we heard sometime last year, though, that there was a poll, and I want to say it was somebody said it in committee, but it seemed like that two-thirds of Oregonians wanted to decide this for themselves. In other words, they didn't want the legislature to do it. And I can't remember where that came from, if it was from a news outlet or if somebody testified, but I seem to recall that. But, you know, I'm old and my memory may fail me on that. But I think overall, I understand that people are trying to do good by this, but I think there's going to be a lot of negative in terms of the impact. And so while I think that Oregonians in the last round of ballot measure where they raised the minimum wage, I think they believe that they're doing good and that they were keeping people at a level by creating the annual CPI increase. And I think about 14 out of 16 years in the past 14 to 16 years, the minimum wage has increased 14 out of 16 times, I think. It's something like that. I think it's only hasn't increased a couple of times. Unfortunately, this year is one of them. But there's no question that some people are going to win in this, but I think there's going to be a lot more people that lose than than those who are supporting this believe, because I don't want to believe that you think that they will lose and that you're okay with that. I want to believe that you think, just don't believe that. But because no state has ever done this, I think that it's essentially untested. So, you know, why, if we're going to do this, why shouldn't we do $25 an hour? Why shouldn't we do 50? Why shouldn't everybody be rich and have a $50 minimum wage and make sure that it applies to small business owners as well? And the reason is because there is going to be economic reaction to it. And you can't really suspend the laws of economics, because ultimately they will work themselves out and businesses will determine what they have to do to survive. And a lot of that's going to be incredibly negative. And so for those reasons and many more, I just can't support moving the minimum wage this far, this fast, you know, with this particular bill.
Thank you, Senator. Further comments?
Mr. Chair, I only have one thing to add to that. I agree with everything, all the sentiments expressed, but I guess maybe we can congratulate ourselves for increasing jobs and enhancing the economy of Idaho.
Thank you, Vice Chair. Senator Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it will come as no surprise to the members of the committee that I see this a little differently. I would point out that Oregon has a very long, proud tradition and history with the minimum wage. We had the very first minimum wage law in the country. It was passed because a nun named Sister Miriam Teresa back in 1911 went to work in the sweatshops in downtown Portland where there were no minimum wages, and she worked alongside women and was appalled by the working conditions and the piece rate they were being paid, and came down here to the legislature and got a 25-cent an hour wage law for women passed. And that became the model for the Fair Labor Standards Act nationally. And since that, we have addressed this issue periodically, but not for a very long time has the legislature voted to raise the minimum wage. I think it was 1989, the last time the minimum wage went up by a vote of the legislature. Since then, it's gone up two times by initiatives, and I am proud to say that I was a chief petitioner in 2002 when we got our current law to have the wage go up annually based on the cost of living. However, though some who opposed that before are now saying it works perfectly well, it does not work perfectly well. This is a year that dramatically shows that we have over 100,000 people in the state working for $9.25 an hour, which is basically $74 a day. And we know that nobody in any part of Oregon could support themselves, just one person, on $74 a day. And certainly in the urban areas, that's not possible. So it is long past time to look at our law and address it and raise wages for not just these 100,000 people, but other people too that are working slightly above the minimum wage. And who are they? Well, the majority of these workers are women. And the majority of these workers are over 20. So they're not teenagers that we're talking about who are just working part-time to buy some movie tickets or CDs. We're talking about people who are working hard every day, growing our food, taking care of our kids, taking care of our elderly parents in nursing homes, and also serving our food in restaurants and working in hospitality. And these are hard jobs. Whether anybody thinks that their jobs people should stay in for very long, a lot of people in Oregon do stay in these jobs and try to support themselves and very often support kids too. So we've got to do something. Is this proposal perfect? Indeed it is not. I would have preferred another version of this, as some of the witnesses have said, that raised our wages more quickly. And I would have preferred to do away with the preemption in our law that keeps local governments from being able to do what they think is appropriate. But the art, politics being the art of the possible, a lot of great work has gone into this proposal, particularly on the part of you, Mr. Chair, and many other people that have worked hard. And I think that this proposal will do a lot of good for our economy, for having a not one-size-fits-all proposal, but ultimately for the hardworking Oregonians that are struggling far too hard just to put food on the table, let alone to pay rent that is unaffordable in our state. Now we have some of the highest housing costs in the country, and that alone would tell me that it's time to pass this bill. So that is why, though I don't think it is perfect, nothing here is ever perfect, I am wholeheartedly supporting it today. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much, Senator Rosenbaum. Senator Gelser, do you want to make any comments?
I think the committee has done a good job of putting it all out there.
Thank you. Okay, I'll just make a few comments, and we may actually be able to end this by 3 or right around then. I know some members have other obligations, so I'll reserve a lot of my comments for when this gets to the floor. But I do want to say that you know, I really appreciate all the discussion that has gone into this and all the public testimony that's come in, and I do believe that that public testimony has helped us to come up with what I think is, as Senator Rosenbaum described it, not a perfect bill, but one that will do really a lot. you know, I would not, you know, I wish I could say, I wish I could say, as Senator Knope did, that Oregon is way out there ahead of the rest of the country because we're proud of our accomplishments, you know. But, you know, in fact, other states are also moving their wages up. Oregon used to be the second in the nation, have the second highest in the nation. We're now number 9. And, you know, the numbers that Senator Knope gave are the current rates. But, you know, in Seattle, for example, you know, that although it's, what did you say, 2013? You said $13. You know, it's on its way to $15 an hour. Which it will achieve around the same time as our bill does. Many states are taking action on this. And why? Because, you know, they're seeing a real need among their residents. Senator Rosenbaum mentioned the effort of which Oregon was the first to create a minimum wage, and she referenced the Fair Labor Standards Act, which President Roosevelt instituted or advocated for, and then it passed in Congress in 1938, which created the first federal minimum wage. And just to quote from him when he proposed that, you know, he said that no business which depends for existence on paying less than living wages to its workers has any right to continue in this country. So the notion of the minimum wage being connected to the notion of a living wage is one that really goes way back. Many of us have come to think of the minimum wage as purely an entry wage, something for teenagers, and, you know, they work their first couple of months on the job, and then they start moving up the pay scale. And I wish that were true, but it's not, and it's increasingly not the case. We see too many workers stuck, if not at the minimum wage, very close to it. And that is a lot of what I believe is requiring us to move on this issue. We had, as I mentioned, a long series of conversations about this that began even during the last legislative session, and that, you know, exposed me to a lot of research and a lot of thinking about this. And I would really recommend to everyone, I've had posted on OLIS a couple of studies, one, the very extensive study that was done by UC Berkeley in making recommendations to Los Angeles when it was considering its wage increase. And then I've also included a third-party review of that analysis. So it's pretty rigorous, in which that third party looked at, was this biased? How did the methodology reflect the best current thinking in the world of economics? Both of them, really suggest clearly to us that there will certainly be individual impacts of this rise. Overall, it will not have a negative effect on the economy. What was being proposed for Los Angeles, which, by the way, is a much more rapid increase than we're looking at, and could have a positive overall benefit to, the overall economy. And so, I think it's really important for us to look at those studies that really reflect the current economic thinking, which, I am pleased to see that the report from Legislative Revenue Office does take into account the secondary indirect effects of what happens when you raise people's wages in terms of their added spending power and the stimulative effect it can have on the economy. I want to say that, in looking at this proposal, these Dash 13 amendments, I would say that they are really the reverse of the legislature trying to drive a wedge between urban counties and rural counties. They're really an attempt by us to look at the particular needs of different parts of the state and to try to make those decisions about, which counties land where on really evidence-based decisions. And, some people might argue with particular choices, but I think overall that was, I can assure you that that was the methodology that was used, and I think we did a good job. Now, I do want to stress that this passing the minimum wage is not going to be by any means a silver bullet for the problems faced by low-income Oregonians. We are still, as Senator Knope recommended, going to need to look at increasing our earned income tax credit. We are going to need to look at people who are dependent on child care and through our employment-related daycare programs. We're going to have to look at housing. We are looking at housing very closely this session, trying to come up with strategies for making housing more affordable. There is no one silver bullet to the poverty problem, but raising the minimum wage is going to go really a long way. The other thing I would say is that there is going to be more work on this to do in the future. As I mentioned here to this committee, I am really concerned about the issue of youth employment and the responsibility of the state to help young Oregonians get into the workforce. I sit on the Oregon Workforce Investment Board, as does my counterpart in the House, Paul Holvey, who chairs the Business and Labor Committee. And we are both committed to working over the next year on how we can, as a state, improve our youth training programs, looking at various ways that we can get more youth into the workforce, ideally in time for summer 2017, through legislation that we can enact next year. I also think it's going to be really important for us as a state to look at things like the challenges that we've heard about people on fixed incomes and those nonprofits that are served through state contracts and often employ people at the low end of the wage spectrum. And look at some of the increased revenues that are being projected to come in as a result of this bill and think about how we can use some of those, how we can target some of those revenues for programs that serve the needy in the state, and that, you know, can help with increased training in the state. So, you know, finally, I just want to say that the easiest thing for us as legislators to do would be to just let this go on the ballot. I have to say that I have not heard from any. I've also gotten a lot of emails for people both in support and opposed to raising the minimum wage. I haven't heard from anyone who is opposed to the minimum wage who urged me to let it go to the ballot. I think we all know that the legislative solution is a legislative route is the better route. I think that we are, you know, we're legislators, and it would be easier to walk away from this, but I think it's more important for us to step up to balance the needs of workers and business in this state and come up with something that's best for Oregon, and I think that's what we've done. So with that, Corey, would you please call the roll?
Senator Gelser?
Yes.
Senator Canope?
No, and I serve notice of a possible minority report.
Senator Rosenbaum?
Aye.
Vice Chair Thatcher?
No, and I also serve notice of a possible minority report.
Aye. The motion carries. Senate Bill 1532, as amended, will go to the floor with a due pass recommendation. I'll carry it. Okay, with that, I'll close our work session on Senate Bill 1532. Colleagues, we are adjourned. I hope you have some sort of weekend. We are adjourned. We are adjourned.